This is Climate One.
We see more severe flooding all around the world. Heat waves are becoming longer and more extreme and deadlier as well.
TV meteorologists are on the front lines. They're the voice of authority when a climate disaster hits their communities, the same communities they also call home.
When it is deadly, when it is producing damaging winds such as a tornado or could take your home from you, or a flash flood event or a big snowstorm, they are living through that with you.
But the causes of our extreme weather are not something everyone wants to hear. And some local meteorologists face major pushback.
We just need to keep going, presenting the facts and empowering people to make good decisions.
TV meteorologists in the eye of the storm, up next on Climate One.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, E9.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Check out playlists, podcasts, and more at KAXE.org. We receive support from the First State Bank of Big Fork and their Kellyer branch, banking that fits a customer's sense of adventure, offering tools for managing money on any mobile device. Member FDIC. Minnesota author Art Colson will give a reading at the Bemidji Public Library Thursday, November 14th at 5 p.m. He'll also be at Brainerd Public Library Friday, November 15th at 3:30. Although primarily known for his books for young readers, he will read from his new books for adults. Bemidji Community Theater presents Scrooge, a musical adaptation of A Christmas Carol, November 15th through the 24th. Tickets available at BemidjiCommunityTheater.com.
I'm Greg Dalton.
I'm Ariana Brocious.
And this is Climate One. Before we get into this week's episode, we need to acknowledge the re-election of Donald Trump and the profound implications for energy and climate. In his first term, he eroded years of progress on environmental and climate goals. On the campaign trail, he vowed to gut the IRA. And in his election night speech this week, he promised to tap what he called the vast stores of liquid gold on America's public lands. Drill, baby, drill is coming back.
So now it may be up to state and city governments to continue addressing the climate crisis. And there are meaningful actions those entities can take. Much of the energy we use runs through wires and pipes regulated locally via building codes and land use policies.
Of course, we'll be following all of that in the coming weeks and months here on Climate One.
The election really drove home how divided our country is. But there is something we all experience the same way, and that's the weather. That's what we're going to talk about on today's show. Specifically, the people we rely upon to let us know if it's going to rain or shine.
Right. TV meteorologists are beamed and streamed into many people's homes every day, and they're often the only scientists the general public hears from on a regular basis.
And more often than not, they live in the places they're reporting on. They're talking about storms and floods and extreme heat that they're also experiencing firsthand. Weathercasters are trusted by their communities.
Weather reporting used to be way less complicated. Give the temperature, tell the people if it's going to rain, and banter with the news team. In fact, David Letterman got his start as a weathercaster.
Most of Missouri is under a flash flood watch. The same holds true for Iowa, and flooding all over. In fact, portions of...
His college degree was in telecommunications, so I think it's fair to say that he was more of an entertainer than scientist.
And then there's Al Roker, who's been on TV forecasting the weather since 1974.
He's a legit climate guy. I saw him speak at a climate conference last year.
Yeah, and as the weather has gotten more and more extreme, he started including climate messaging in his forecasts.
United States is 1 degree warmer on average than 20 years ago. Take a look at some of these stats. The 90-year trend, 1 to 4 degrees of warming across much of the United States. And so our climate obviously is changing, and we continue to watch it. For today, sunny and cool temperatures.
According to a recent study out of Yale, 60% of Americans are worried about global warming. Some TV meteorologists say that the majority of their viewers want to hear about climate connections in their weather reporting. For others, that's controversial.
Climate doubters may be a noisy minority, But all of us are seeing more and more extreme weather hitting closer to home, happening more often. And no one knows this better than John Morales. He's based in Miami, and he reports on the weather for NBC 6. He's been in the business for 40 years. You might not know his name, but you might have seen the video of him that went viral in October during Hurricane Milton. Here was this expert reacting to one of the most terrifying hurricanes he'd ever seen.
Incredible, incredible hurricane. It has dropped. It has dropped 50 millibars in 10 hours. I apologize. This is just horrific. Winds, maximum sustained winds are 160 miles per hour. And it is just gaining strength in the Gulf of Mexico, where you can imagine the winds, I mean, the seas are just so incredibly, incredibly hot. A record hot, as you might imagine. You know what's driving that. I don't need to tell you. Global warming, climate change, leading to this and becoming an increasing threat for
the UK. Take us back, if you don't mind, to that moment. What was going through your mind when you were delivering this report to your viewers?
Well, you have to keep in mind, I mean, first off, I was up very, very late the previous night because the NBC station had asked me to be in the studio, particularly because the biggest audience of the week generally follows the big NFL game on Sunday night. But that NFL game got delayed by weather, ironically. The game started very late. The newscast started at 1:15 in the morning. And because I live far from the TV station, basically I didn't get to sleep till between 2:15 and 2:30. And the hurricane was already rapidly intensifying. So I was up early the next day. I got maybe 4 hours of sleep, checking on everything having to do with the hurricane. And for the noon newscast, it was going to be my first newscast of the day. And in the minutes prior to the newscast starting, the National Hurricane Center issued an urgent bulletin indicating that the hurricane had reached Category 5 intensity. Mind you, Sunday morning, we woke up to a mundane 50-mile-per-hour tropical storm. So here was, suddenly, a 160-mile-per-hour Category 5 hurricane within the span of a day. So that news itself is very shocking. And what happened to me was, you know, I'm trying to look at the camera because they're about to present me. I'm looking at these numbers. I'm looking at a chart. I'm seeing the pressure drop. I'm doing the calculation in my head. And suddenly it's my turn to speak. So I clench my eyes. I say what I said about it being an incredible hurricane. And when it was time to talk about the drop in barometric pressure, which is such a significant data point for a meteorologist, right? I mean, you know, you keep in mind, the record-holding fastest intensifying hurricane in the Atlantic Basin dropped 97 millibars in 24 hours. And here's one that did 50 in 10 hours, right? So I'm going, this thing is the most incredible hurricane I've ever seen.
I want to underscore one thing, which I think is really interesting, that you said in the tape, I apologize. And that's a natural thing to say because you're a professional and we were sort of taught not to express emotion, but you're also trying to communicate that this is a really, really serious thing coming right now. And I feel like you were just kind of being a human. And I'm curious what you were thinking. Like, did you feel that you needed to apologize? Did you feel that you had somehow overstepped or?
Yeah. I mean, I was just a little bit embarrassed. I mean, to be completely honest, I didn't see that coming. I mean, there are underlying reasons that I can point to as introspection of how I got to that point. However, I could have not expected it to make me, you know, break down or lose my composure on TV. And by the way, I mean, there's a lot, you know, I've been doing hurricane coverage for decades, and there's a lot of other, you know, semi-viral moments that have happened along the years. I mean, you know, I've cursed on TV and didn't get fired. I sometimes I've been extremely stern with the public, You know, I remember this time during Hurricane Irma telling people in the Florida Keys, you know, my statement was, if you're sitting on a Florida Key right now, get out, right? Yeah. So I mean, there's all these, but this one was different. It was different because while I've paused and almost lost it before during Hurricane Maria's threat on Puerto Rico, the eve of the hurricane, because, of course, Puerto Rico is where I grew up. My mother lives down there. I mean, I did have that type of a moment on social media, but not like this, not to the point where my voice was quivering to the point where it did here. So back to your question, why did I apologize? I think it was awkward and a little bit embarrassing. It was a natural thing to do.
And, you know, for viewers that have been watching you for decades, you know, it kind of underscored that you are a person in the community that, you know, they trust you, you bring them reliable reporting, that you care. And I think that that really transcends the screen in a sense. But this happened when the news was still fresh with images of Hurricane Helene, which of course wreaked havoc on the East Coast, killed more than 230 people. And so for Floridians who know and trust you, this did really drive home the urgency of this particular storm. And I'm curious, what have you been seeing and reading and researching in your career that has gotten to today where we're really seeing these incredible storms happen?
Yeah, well, for perspective, people have to realize 2024 is my 40th anniversary as a professional meteorologist. It's been a long, long time. And my entire career, except for 5 weeks that I spent in Washington, D.C., but the rest of my career has always been in the tropics and subtropics. I've been monitoring, analyzing, and forecasting hurricanes for 40 years, right? So the changes I've observed them in real time, and there have been changes, right? And by the way, I mean, I'm going to say these things, and I'm just not just saying them anecdotally because John Morales saw them. These are things that are backed up by peer-reviewed science, right? And there is definitely a greater proportion of the tropical cyclones that are forming anywhere in the world that are reaching violent Category 4 and 5 intensities. It's not that there are more tropical storms and hurricanes as a whole. It's not that the count of every single tropical storm and hurricanes is higher. But the percentage of the ones that are forming are reaching these incredible intensities. And it's just happening at the drop of a hat now. So one of the things that I wrote about last year after Hurricane Otis, which went from a nothing to a Category 5 and absolutely flattened Acapulco, basically without warning, okay? And imagine the suffering those folks went through and the surprise those folks went through in having to deal with a Category 5, which I'll add another parenthesis. Nothing bothers me more than people on social media, clapping back. Well, you know, you were so concerned about Milton as a Cat 5, and look it, you know, it got to the coast as a Cat 3. That's no big deal. Yeah, no big deal. You know, why don't you go through a Cat 3 and tell me what it's like? Anything that is Cat 3 and higher is devastating. And if it's Category 4 or higher, it's basically catastrophic. Catastrophic. Puerto Rico saw it. You know, the Keys saw it. The Bahamas saw it. Texas saw it. Louisiana saw it. One of these days, there's going to be a mundane tropical storm in the central Bahamas, which 36 hours later is going to make landfall in Miami as a Category 4 hurricane and catch everybody off guard. That's my market, okay? This is the market I've been on TV for 33 years. An audience that knows me very, very well. And they've known me as a non-alarmist, as a just-the-facts meteorologist. But if now there's a higher chance than there's ever been in our lifetimes for a 50-mile-an-hour tropical storm in, you know, the central Bahamas, making it to Miami as a Cat 4 a day and a half later, if that's the case today, I'm not sure I can continue to be a non-alarmist. It's changed the way that I deliver the weather.
Well, and you're referencing, you know, obviously the things you know most and are experiencing there are hurricanes, but if we're seeing the same kind of growing intensity of a lot of other weather events too, right? Intense rainfall, flooding, intense droughts, a lot of things are being amplified by climate. And so, you know, even in that clip we heard at the top, you make that connection pretty quickly. You say this, we know what's causing this. It's warmer oceans, it's climate. So, you live in Florida, which, you know, is a conservative state. And so for some, climate change, the term even, could be politicized or viewed as politicized. What do your viewers expect around the, you know, what is in your newscasts or your weathercasts and how much of it touches on climate?
Well, I'm proud to say that, you know, there's basically a handful or less than a handful of weathercasters in the U.S. that dared start to provide climate context going back 20 years. You know, Jim Gandy in South Carolina, Mike Nelson in Denver, myself, maybe one or two other people. I mean, it's a very small group. So that means that my station was definitely on the forefront of you know, communicating climate context to the viewers, even within weather segments, because it's one thing to do what I basically started doing way back in the 90s and into the aughts. I would do longer format type of environmental / climate reporting with all the challenges of false equivalency that journalists were requiring of me. By journalists, I mean, you know, managers in the newsroom that don't understand that the scientific process does not yield two sides to the coin, right? But journalists are trained to always present both sides of a story. So it's very difficult for a scientist to be presenting science when you're asked to, you know, find somebody that disputes the theory of gravity, right? Anyways, so all those challenges. But that morphed into inserting climate into the actual weather segment, into our 2 or 3 minute weather segment. And that happened, well, first because I would have rather asked for forgiveness than permission. It's because I did not ask for permission. I just started to talk about it more. And then the opportunities start to multiply, sadly. Extreme weather events multiplied in this century, starting in the aughts, through the teens, and now into the 20s. Every year, we get more billion-dollar disasters in the U.S. We see more severe flooding all around the world. Heat waves are becoming longer and more extreme and deadlier as well. All these are symptoms of a warming climate. And when these things happen, and they're part of my weather segment, I normally follow it by saying something as simple as, and you see what you're seeing here happen? Is consistent with what you would expect in a warming planet and was predicted to happen decades ago by climate scientists. And that allows people to make that connection. And it's important that broadcast meteorologists do that more often.
John Morales is a hurricane specialist at NBC6 in South Florida. Thank you so much for joining us on Climate One.
Great to be here. Thanks.
After the break, we'll talk with another meteorologist who's trying to bring climate news to his audience, no matter where they sit politically.
I found another way to kind of cover it that helped both liberal and conservative part of the audience appreciate the issue.
That's up next when Climate One continues.
You can find hundreds of past episodes on all aspects of climate on our website, climateone.org. Or subscribe to our podcast wherever you listen.
KAXE, we keep it local.
Then I realized how important my art was to me, how it calms me. It takes all my cares and my woes away.
I'd like to show the community, let the community see that we can do some riskier, surprising things. Like, this is the first time that as a community theater group, we've really jumped this far outside of the box, right? And I would love for that to be.
I think we're inherently a species that is genetically engineered to take care of each other and to take care of the environment in which we live.
It seems like a lot of people in our region are sharing this concern about potential for emergencies with their animals during after hours.
I'm Jennifer Barr. We need your support to keep it local. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you so much.
This is Climate One. I'm Greg Dalton.
And I'm Arianna Brocious.
We've talked about how TV meteorologists are in a unique position. They can reach people that other climate scientists and communicators often can't.
And it's also true that TV meteorologists aren't always climate scientists themselves. And with the huge amount of new information coming out that might shape their reporting, they don't always have the time or the resources to dig into the research, especially as they're preparing to go live on the air every day.
But there's a program that offers them tools to better understand and more effectively communicate the reality of the climate crisis. Bernadette Woods Plackey leads Climate Matters, an organization that provides resources like data analysis, localized graphics, and science explainers to local media who want to tell climate stories.
Not long ago, a lot of TV meteorologists were skeptical about climate change. They were a tough audience. And from the polls really moved from 2010 to 2017, from about half to almost all of meteorologists accepting that climate change is happening. So what changed during that time frame with this audience?
Well, I think that there's a few things that changed. First of all, most TV meteorologists weren't anti-science. They just had questions, and they were looking for a solid source to answer those questions.
Yeah, I get that. And I'm having to still puzzled by that after the IPCC had come out with so many reports and there was this international consensus that this group of professionals trained in meteorology still didn't accept, you know, the scientific consensus. But I guess...
Well, there are a lot of people out there, unfortunately, who weren't accepting of the science, correct? And you're correct that they are trained in atmospheric science. There was also a lot of misinformation out there that was coming at TV meteorologists. And that misinformation was targeted at them. And so that adds another layer of their confusion of who to trust, who not to trust with the state of the science as it continued to evolve as they were actively working. And you have to understand that TV...
Can I just ask, are you saying the oil industry, the fossil fuel industry, targeted TV meteorologists in their misinformation campaign?
Well, the Heritage Foundation had sent out information to TV meteorologists during this time.
Okay, so that's a yes. So they were targeted. And I remember seeing and holding in my hand some real slick materials intended to sow doubt.
Most of my learning around climate change came in this current position at Climate Central. I didn't know as much when I was on air, but I don't think I was unique. Most TV meteorologists they ground themselves in science, but they're not keeping up with every single publication that comes out academically, with every other thing that they're balancing. And then on top of that, think about this. So TV meteorologists are used to being told all the time how they're wrong, right? And so they want to really understand the scientific connection to something before they feel that confidence going forward. So we came in from Climate Central and our collection of friends with George Mason University, the American Meteorological Society, NASA, NOAA, all under this NSF grant that formed Climate Matters and was able to work with them to hear what questions they had, help answer those questions, bring scientists forward who are working in those specific areas where they may have had questions around modeling or data records, and then continue to build that trust with TV meteorologists on where the state of the science was, how they could use language around it, where their audience was with questions around climate change, and how to answer those questions. You have science, you have public opinion on your side. People are genuinely asking you what is happening, and they're looking for information, and you're in that position to make those connections for them.
Bernadette Woods-Plackey, thank you so much for sharing your insights with us on Climate One.
Well, thank you for having me.
Resources like Climate Matters are really valuable for people in the media who want to tell climate stories clearly and accurately. But what if not everyone in the audience wants to hear them? That's what happened to Chris Gloninger, and it upended his life. In 2021, he was working as a TV meteorologist in Boston. Then he got offered what seemed like an incredible opportunity. A station in Des Moines, Iowa, wanted to bring him on as chief meteorologist, and they specifically wanted climate change to be a big part of his weathercasting. This was exactly the kind of reporting Gloninger had wanted to do for his entire career. But he told me that back when he started out, he was a bit of an outlier.
When I got into the profession in 2006, I was told flat out you couldn't cover climate change. You couldn't talk about climate change. It was kind of taboo at the time. And then we entered into this phase where news directors or news managers in general would say, you need to tell both sides. And in journalism, that is known as a false balance, where there's plenty of scientific evidence that shows that humans are causing climate change versus the idea that climate change is a hoax. But it was in 2016 where I really picked up some momentum in covering climate change, and that eventually, around 2018, launched the country's first weekly series on climate change in Boston on NBC. And that series aired every single week, which was super rewarding.
Yeah. And to have pioneered something like that is really cool. I mean, you obviously, I would assume, had support at the time from your station. Were you in charge of most of that content? Were you creating it?
I had the help of an executive producer. And for us to pitch a weekly series, we needed to have a sustainable stream of content. And management at the time, I think, worried that we'd run dry of stories. But in a city like Boston, it was impossible. It was overwhelming how much content there was. And then it turned into prioritizing which stories we really needed to tell immediately, right? The infrastructure system, the T or the subway system in Boston, incredibly vulnerable. And that was one of the first stories that we covered versus other stories about the switch to renewable energy or the mitigation side of it, which is important. But really, we're starting to see chronic flooding. We needed to tell those stories up front. Mm-hmm. The management at the time saw it and said, yeah, okay, we'll give you this series and you can do it weekly.
Cool. Okay, so you've been in Boston, and in 2021, you were offered a job as chief meteorologist in Des Moines, Iowa at KCCI. And this was a big step for you, right? It was a promotion. It was also a quite different place than where you'd been living. So what did you think about when that offer came in, that job offer came in?
I was optimistic. And to be honest with you, I wouldn't have left a job in a top 10 market just even for a title to be chief meteorologist. I left the opportunity in Boston for this new job because it was the chance to speak to an audience that hadn't really heard about climate change. Previous chief meteorologist at the station, the previous two chiefs didn't cover it, didn't talk about it, didn't integrate it into their evening newscast. I saw it as an opportunity.
Yeah. So let's get into that. So you accepted the offer. Talk about kind of how you began to do that, how you incorporated climate into your experience working there.
We wondered when the right time would be to do it. But we had one of the hottest summers on record. We had the largest tornado outbreak on record in the state of Iowa, and it didn't happen during tornado season. It didn't happen during tornado season. It happened in December. It happened a couple of weeks before Christmas. I said, we need to do this now. And I would find ways to weave it in to my weathercast. It wasn't a standalone feature that I did in Boston, where I was the weekend meteorologist and did the climate reporting during the week. But I would regularly tie it in to the evening newscast in only 30 to 45 seconds. Wasn't preaching, wasn't talking down to people in a way where I was educating them or feeling that they didn't have the education to understand what I was talking about or the understand the science of climate change. But I found ways to kind of connect with viewers and talk about how many more 90-degree days we had during the summer, to talk about how we're seeing an increase in heavy rain events causing flash flooding. But at this flip side, we have this weather whiplash where we can go into extreme droughts in a short amount of time. But then I found another way to kind of cover it that helped both liberal and conservative part of the audience appreciate the issue. Because what's lost on many news managers, many that are in the communication side of climate change, is that there are ways that you can find and connect with the conservative audience, that the science can resonate with them by using their terminology and their philosophies, including, for example, energy independence. What's more independent than harvesting energy in your own backyard? Not only did these wind turbines provide a huge boost to the power grid, they were supplemental income for farmers who had a bad season.
I want to dig into this idea of reaching other audiences or broader audiences. Did you specifically use the words climate change, that phrase, when you would talk about this on the news?
I did. I went back and forth with station management, and ultimately when they told me to stop talking about it, it wasn't just using a different phrase. It was just avoiding the topic altogether because they were worried about the pushback. I didn't use it all the time, though. I would say you can see the overall trend. As carbon dioxide goes up, the atmospheric temperature goes up. That is a causation. That is a causation relationship where with one going up, the other follows. I didn't want to turn people off, but I also thought it was important to kind of integrate it for people to realize that it isn't a polarized issue. It's science, facts, data.
So you were there covering climate, covering the weather. By the following summer, things had changed at the station, as you kind of touched on. The management told you there were too many viewer complaints coming in about the quote-unquote politicization of the weather forecast. They wanted to hear less about climate change. So what was your response to the station management then?
Yeah, the station management at the time brought me out to lunch. And it's kind of comedic because I later found out I was brought to a public setting so I wouldn't be visibly upset. And they would curb my emotions when I was told that I could no longer do what I was hired to do, which I would hope at that point I'd be professional enough in a nearly 20-year career to be able to have a civil conversation. But I certainly wasn't going to just roll over. I said I disagreed with their approach. I, in a bit of snark, said the term COVID has become a polarized term. So imagine covering the pandemic without being able to use the term. It just doesn't make sense. And I said, you're allowing a small part of the viewing audience to editorialize our newscasts. That goes against any ethics of journalism that exist. You shouldn't be doing that because we're simply stating facts. And they kept saying, well, research doesn't care about the how or the why. And then it got down to the point where they were writing me up for obscure things. I promoted a tweet from Patagonia that said that they were giving all of their profits to charitable organizations, to nonprofits that were doing work in the climate space. And I said, what an amazing company. You know, where do I sign up? I mean, a harmless tweet like that. But that was taken and turned into I don't have journalistic ethics because I tweeted that out. I mean, that's truly ridiculous, but we got to that point.
So speaking of Twitter, in July of that year, you wrote something on Twitter that I'd like to ask you to read for us.
Yeah. My climate coverage has garnered negative feedback, but last month I received the first threat followed by a flow of harassing emails. Police are investigating. It's mentally exhausting, and at times I've not been okay.
So I know this was a really difficult experience. Can you take us back to what was happening and what you were feeling then?
Yeah, look, as meteorologists, we are seasoned for the occasional, hey, you know, you were forecasting dry weather and it rained on my wedding day. Yeah, that's a bummer. That's terrible, right? And I fully anticipate and expect people to write in and say that, to air their grievances, right? This was different. This targeted my safety. This targeted the safety of my family. It was not just one email, and it reached a peak when I was getting back from a haircut. My wife was out running errands, and I read and reread and reread this email as I just, my mind was racing. But I think we've all had that experience where you feel paralyzed, your heart's pumping, your brain is racing, but you physically can't do anything. It's almost like you wake up out of a nightmare and you're not sure what's happening. And I called my wife as soon as I was grounded and said, where are you? And she said, I'm out shopping still. I said, you need to come home. I'll explain when you get here, but I'll be calling the police as well. And she beat the police to the house by a few minutes. So I showed her the email. She was shaken. It was the same person who sent a series of harassing emails who asked what our home address was, and they'd like to give us an Iowa welcome, kind of like what the blanks tried to do to Justice Kavanaugh. And police knew instantly that that was a death threat, because it was when a subject was apprehended with zip ties and weapons trying to attack, presumably kill, Justice Kavanaugh. And they said they were concerned because this wasn't just a hey, we're going to kill you. This had essentially a plan. And there's no way to truly explain the mental trauma. I was a firefighter in college. It's something I did for 4 years. I saw horrific scenes with tremendous loss. But the psychological toll that this took ultimately ended up with a year constant therapy. And even to this day, when I hear threats made against some of my colleagues regarding weather modification, it just reopens the wound.
I'm sorry. Thanks for sharing that. I realize it's a lot to revisit. So you took stock of everything. And left the station. And it was that threat, right? But everything.
Yeah. I think if it was just one thing, we would have been able to manage and push through. But when you make a personal sacrifice, and I think I now am more emotional about this than I am even the death threat, when you make that decision to go to a new part of the country, uproot, invest in this new town, make friendships, try to do everything you can to become part of this community, and then you feel like you were abandoned. Honestly, it's unforgivable what station management did. I look back at it and, I mean, it was the ultimate form of betrayal. And I wasn't going to stay there just to be chief meteorologist.
Yeah.
I'm pretty open about this. I mean, I went into a sector which pays what it pays. I love my new employer, but ultimately took a $70,000 pay cut, which is really hard to stomach. But I did it because this is the biggest issue of our lifetime. I wasn't going to get paid just to tell people what the next 7 days were going to be like. I just didn't feel like that was right. I felt like I should be doing more. So it's been a year of a lot of ups and downs, a lot of struggles, a lot of hardships. But I think that the rawest emotion I have is the sense and feeling of betrayal. And I felt like I was crazy. They were telling me to stop talking about it, yet they hired me to do that. And I felt like I was literally going crazy. Like, did I misinterpret what they were saying? Was it, you know, mixed messaging? Where did this go off the rails? But there was this tweet that I saw that was when the Washington Post first covered the story. It was Matt Serwey, is now a meteorologist in Minneapolis. And he wrote and said, I interviewed for this position and it was heavy on climate. Meaning that's what the station wanted. And I hope that they gave him the support he needed. Sure, they put me up in a hotel until we get a security system installed. But the support that I really needed was the support to keep going, to keep being a climate messenger, not an activist, but a messenger in a way of bringing science to the people for them to understand why this is such a critical issue. And they didn't accommodate that. But that kind of gave me peace of mind that I wasn't crazy, that that was in fact what they wanted until they didn't, until that they allowed a small part of the viewing audience to editorialize their newscasts, which is journalistically unethical.
So one of the most, I think, rewarding outcomes of this for you is that you found after you left, you had actually reached a lot of people and that they were really grateful for your coverage. So can you tell us about that? What kind of support you found after your departure?
Yeah, it was kind of sad to see. It's a little too late. And I printed out every single email that I received from just Iowa viewers. I mean, when it became an international story, I got emails and support from all over the world, which is truly inspiring. But I thought what was more meaningful was the fact that they never showed me their research on the fact that people they claimed didn't want to hear about climate change. And I went through and I had this friend who I call my Iowa dad, who's a trial attorney out in Iowa. And he made multiple copies at his law office of all these emails, hundreds of them. And I put post-it notes on the letters from truly conservative parts of the state, from Pocahontas to Sheridan to, I mean, areas that are so red that I was pretty confident that these people that were writing were conservative who appreciated what I was doing. And as a parting gift, I gave one of the binders to my bosses and said, I don't know where you got your research from. I don't know who you paid, what consulting firm to do this, but this is invaluable research that you couldn't really even pay for. This is every email just from the Iowans that I've heard from, and gave it to them on my way out.
Good for you. Chris Gloninger is a former TV meteorologist, now working as the senior climate scientist at Woods Hole Group. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing your story on Climate One.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks so much.
We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, meteorologist Amber Sullins describes how broken heat records in the summer of 2020 got her Phoenix audience interested in climate change.
We were not breaking heat records by a day or two or a degree or two. We were beating them by weeks, by 10, 12 degrees. I mean, it was ridiculous.
That's up next when Climate One continues.
Here at KAXE, we're all about creating community. Whether it's discussing arts or music or upcoming events, we can't do what we do here at KXE without your support and your participation. And we do that by inviting others to take part in the conversation.
I really value the opportunity to speak to folks via the radio and the other media outlets because I've found that that's where people find their information the most. I can post it on Facebook or Instagram all I want, but people are coming to the show, I think, because of the communities that are built around places like KAXE. So it's just incredibly valuable opportunity to be able to talk about it and share and invite people in.
Inviting others to take part in the conversation is what makes KAXE special. Without your input and support, we wouldn't be able to do what we do here at KAXE so well. So continue showing that support by becoming a member. And you can do that by visiting our website at kaxe.org.
Many miles and weather systems away in Phoenix, Arizona, Amber Sullins has been broadcasting since the early 2000s. As stretches of extreme heat get more intense and last longer, she's also tried to incorporate more climate messaging into her work.
You know, as a broadcast meteorologist, my job every day is to tell the weather story, right? Like what is going to happen, get people through their day, get people through the next few days, but also provide context. And, you know, when I started out in the early 2000s, the only way that meteorologists were doing that is just through the Daily Almanac. Here's our high today. This is what's average. This is the record. And it was just as simple as that. But in 2013, I really started incorporating more perspective because things were changing. Things were changing all around us. And as someone who looks at the data every day and is completely engrossed in this, those changes were so obvious to me.
Right. How do viewers respond when you started to talk more about this context and use that word climate?
Yeah. So back in 2013, when I first started doing it, there was a little bit of resistance, people not wanting to connect it to climate change, just chalk it up to another extreme weather event. But I think as far as what's happening here in Phoenix, what really changed perspective for a lot of people that I serve in this community was the summer of 2020, when we were just absolutely shattering heat records. And we were not breaking heat records by a day or two or a degree or two. We were beating them by weeks, by 10, 12 degrees. I mean, it was a ridiculous amount of heat in terms of just how hot it was and how long the heat lasted. And I think from that point forward, especially native Phoenicians like me who have been here for decades, really knew that something was not right. This is not normal for us. What is going on?
Right. So 2020 was a big jump, shocked people. And it continued to get hotter in 2023.
Yeah.
Health officials in Maricopa County reported nearly 500 heat-related deaths. That still boggles my mind. And you continue to break records. What I think this year is 100 days of temperatures over 100 degrees. You know, how is this year affecting your listeners?
Yeah, I mean, we've had 142 triple-digit days already. And you know what? We might even have a triple-digit day on Saturday. So that would be the second latest triple-digit day ever recorded in Phoenix. So people are, they know that something's changing here. And they want to know why. I mean, some people that don't want to believe or even understand how greenhouse gases are trapping heat and causing the planet to warm, they want to blame it on the urban heat island effect. And here in Phoenix, the urban heat island effect is a major problem. It really elevates temperatures in the overnight hours, but it's not the whole story.
And the heat island effect is when concrete and asphalt absorbs heat from the sun, making cities hotter than surrounding areas.
Yeah. And so I try to give viewers perspective on, you know, here's what's happening with the overnight lows. We know that a vast majority of these really hot overnight temperatures in Phoenix and the center of our heat island are really driven by the heat island effect. But the heat island effect has a much lesser footprint on our daytime highs. And those are getting ridiculously high too. 110 degree days. We now had 70 of those this summer. 70 days at 110 degrees or hotter.
Right. How has all this extreme heat affected you and your family?
Well, I mean, it's a different world. I was born and raised here in Phoenix. So I know how our summers used to be. We used to be able to at least escape the heat by going to the local swimming pool. But now, you know, in the dead of summer, the pool feels like a hot tub. So we're not getting that relief. And then
ew.
Now we're coming into the, it was right. It's very tepid
It's not refreshing. But we're also getting into the heat stretching now so far into fall. So that's affecting our kids when they go back to school. There's days when we're under excessive heat warnings and the little children are not allowed on the playgrounds for recess because it's too hot and dangerous. They have to stay inside. It's affecting the fall sports that our kids are able to participate in. And it's really becoming a dangerous situation in terms of the risk of heat exhaustion and heat stroke while our kids are out playing in these sports. And that even goes into late September and October. We had a 117 degree day in late September this year. It broke the daily record by nearly 10 degrees.
Wow. And this has also hit home for you. Your son is a high school football player. How does it affect him?
Yeah, he plays football. His games are Saturday, middle of the day. And that 117 degree day that I told you about, that was a Saturday. And as a meteorologist, I saw this coming. I saw the heat coming the week leading up to it. And I'm waiting to hear from the coaches. Okay, the game's going to be canceled or it's going to be rescheduled. I hear nothing. And by Thursday, I think to myself, well, my kid can't be the only one having to deal with this. So I start to email leagues all across the valley just saying, hey, this is Amber Sullins, your chief meteorologist at ABC 15. I just want to let you know, in case you haven't checked the weather forecast, that we're under an excessive heat warning on Saturday. It's going to be 117 degrees. What's your heat contingency plan for these games? Because these temperatures are not safe. And the heat risk sent out by the National Weather Service and the CDC says that the risk for heat exhaustion and heat stroke is extreme. Wow. So please let me know what your plan is. And a lot of the leagues got back to me and said, thank you so much for bringing this to our attention. We're making some adjustments. Some leagues didn't respond at all. Some leagues only canceled afternoon games. But I think this goes to another really important point that let's say it's 117, that's our high. We hit that at 4 o'clock in the afternoon this time of year. By noon, it's already up to about 107, which it was that day. 107 degrees at noon is not the same as 107 or 107 degrees at 5 or 6 p.m. because of the UV index. It feels a lot hotter. You're getting that radiational heat on you. So now we have to broaden this. Okay, we can't have the kids out there during the hottest time of the day, but we also can't have the kids out there during the time of day when the UV index, that radiational heating, is making it feel even worse.
So what happened to your son's game?
It did not get canceled. So I woke up Saturday morning and my boys were getting ready for the gate, my son and my husband. And I said, what are you guys doing? And my husband said, well, we're going to go to the game. It wasn't canceled. And I said, what do you mean it wasn't canceled? So, you know, as a meteorologist, I'm, you know, very concerned. I sit down to breakfast with my son and I say, you know, SJ, you know, it's going to be 117 today. And he's like, yeah, Mom, that sounds really bad. I said, how do you think it's going to feel in those pads, those football pads? He's like, yeah, it's going to be brutal. I said, you know, I think you think you can handle it, but let me ask you this. As a quarterback, do you think that the offensive line was supposed to protect you? Do you think that those guys are going to be okay in the heat?
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And he said, yeah, Mom, you're right. I don't think I should go. So we polled him. His team still went out there and played.
Whoa.
And he, you know, he had a little bit of FOMO, a little fear of missing out. He was a little bummed, but I felt like, you know, I had a responsibility as his mother and as a meteorologist who knew better to have this conversation with him and not kind of lay down the law and say, you're absolutely not going, but to give him the information and talk him through it so that he can think critically about whether or not this is a good idea.
Phoenix is pretty conservative area. Are you aware of the political market that you're operating in, whether it's, you know, within the company or within the viewers?
Yeah.
Do you feel like there's some constraints?
Well, you know, I'm very careful to keep everything that I am talking about very, you know, fact-based, because that's what I think people need. And a lot of us, we have different roles in communicating what's happening to our climate. And my role as a meteorologist who works for a journalism company is to stay out of the policy side and to just present the facts And so that's what I do.
And that's what a lot of scientists say, that they just prevent the facts. And yet some scientists have crossed over into advocacy because the confines of their professional conventions, they feel morally, I guess, called to transcend those. Do you ever think about that? Yeah. You know, when you might like take some risk?
Well, you know, I think we all have a role to play, and that it's going to take all of us combined. We can't be all things to all people, right? Everybody is going to have their specific lane and their role to play in this. And mine is to not try to alienate even one single viewer, but to bring them all in.
Amber Sullins, thank you so much for sharing your insights from Phoenix with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening. You can see what our team is reading by subscribing to our newsletter. Sign up at climateone.org.
Climate One is a production of the Commonwealth Club. Our team includes Brad Marshland, Jenny Park, Ariana Brocious, Austin Colon, Megan Basilia, Ben Testani, and Jenny Lawton. Our theme music is by George Young. I'm Greg Dalton.